information, good conversation, unabashedly Wisconsin. This is Up North News Radio. Here's Pat Kreitlow.
And welcome back to the second hour of Up North News Radio. It's a Monday, May 15th, 2023. Nice to have you along. Coming up in this hour, we're going to learn much more about the League of Women Voters of Wisconsin, a group that is dedicated to sharing fact-based information about government and encouraging more participation in civic events. It's part of our continuing series on Mondays. I'll kind of call it Movement Mondays, of trying to increase the movement of groups and increase civic engagement of folks who maybe don't normally vote or don't normally get involved in the political process, and let you know of different ways you can do that. We hear about the League of Women Voters around, you know, election time. They tend to sponsor debates and candidate forums, although more Republicans are refusing to show up there and accusing the League of Women Voters of being a liberal group for having the audacity to, you know, encourage people to vote, because apparently that's a partisan thing now. But the League does things throughout the course of the year, and we'll talk to Deborah about that. And Civic Media News Director Terry Bell will be here with three things to know to start the week. One of the things we can tell you to start the week is that it is never too early for some folks to begin talking about 2024, and not just the presidential race, but the U.S. Senate race in Wisconsin. Tammy Baldwin has already said that she plans to run for a third term in 2024. And as various folks look at the potential Republican field, you know, there have been plenty of names that have come up already. They include folks like Congressman Tom Tiffany up north, Congressman Mike Gallagher from the Green Bay area, former Milwaukee County Sheriff and Showbiz Act David Clark, and others, folks from business. And one name that comes up frequently anytime there's speculation about a Republican field is Eric Hovde, another banker and business owner from Wisconsin. And he is the focus of an article by Dan Bice in this morning's Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And it's all about some property and homes that he has in California with a beautiful view of the Pacific Ocean. And what you see here when you first see the story is you wonder if this is another case of what went on with Tim Michaels last year. You'll recall that a news story came out about Tim Michaels spending as much, if not more, time in Connecticut and New York City than he did in Wisconsin, that he lived in one and then a different mansion in Connecticut on the water, and has a, you know, a penthouse condo in Manhattan, that all three of his kids went to high school in Connecticut and graduated from there. But he says he continued to vote in Wisconsin. But that news story about Tim Michaels was broken by a far-right news site, by a conservative news site that clearly was hoping more for a Rebecca Clefish candidacy to run against Tony Evers. Or, as they said, look, if Michaels is going to be the candidate, better that he be vetted well in advance, you know, by a conservative news site than to have somebody like, you know, Dan Bice put this up in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. So now you have this article this morning about Bice saying that Hovde may run for Senate in Wisconsin, but he's living large in Laguna Beach, California. And he begins by saying, Wisconsin businessman Eric Hovde is looking more and more like a strong U.S. Senate candidate, for California. And then shows how the banker paid nearly $7 million in 2018 to buy a luxurious hillside estate in Laguna Beach, California, with an unimpeded view of the shimmering Pacific Ocean. It cost more than three times what Hovde paid for his Madison home on Lake Mendota. And it talked about him shooting a commercial in California, and that Hovde was named by the Orange County Business Journal as one of its 500 most influential people in Orange County in 2020. Is this the same as the Tim Michaels story? Well, it sure looks like Eric Hovde was expecting this, and at the very least had done his homework, expecting a call from somebody like a Dan Bice. And according to Bice's own article, when contacted last week, Hovde guffawed with amusement when asked if he is spending the majority of his time in California or Wisconsin. And the 59-year-old multimillionaire said, this is laughable. Okay, I'm born in Wisconsin, raised in Wisconsin, graduated from the University of Wisconsin. My home is Wisconsin. I have a business in Wisconsin. So that's my response. But then he was asked about, you know, why shooting the bank for his bank, SunWest, out in California. And he says, guess what? I was shooting old Western commercials for a bank that operates in the West. If you've got to find Western talent and a stagecoach that looks like the Wells Fargo stagecoach, you're pretty well assured that's going to be someplace out West. And then he goes on to say that, you know, folks must be afraid of him if they're already leaking negative information before he's even made a final decision as to whether or not he's going to get into the race. And then Bice goes on to mention not only the Tim Michaels matter, but how former U.S. Senator John McCain couldn't recall how many houses he had in and out of Arizona, and other examples. Whether this is on par with that or not, we don't know, but we do know that it's out there now, so that as Eric Hovde weighs whether to run or not, he is aware that people know he's got some California connections, but is clearly already ready to talk about them. Whether he really wants to challenge Tammy Baldwin or if it becomes another Republican remains to be seen. We'll take a break. We'll have sports. We'll have the full weatherology forecast for a beautiful couple of days to start the week here in Wisconsin. And a little bit later, we'll learn more about the League of Women Voters in Wisconsin and Terry Bell with three things to know to start the week. All that just ahead. You're up north. Our studio line number here is 844-967-2789 for anything that might be on your mind and you want to talk about as we get going on this Monday morning. Before we get to weatherology, quick update on sports. The Brewers swept the Royals over the weekend, winning Friday, Saturday, and Sunday to regain the top spot in the National League Central. Eric Lauer came in from the bullpen in the fourth inning to relieve starter Colin Ray. And Christian Yelich went deep again Sunday after hitting two home runs on Saturday. And the Brewers went on to beat Kansas City yesterday 9-6. They are in St. Louis tonight with Freddie Peralta on the mound again tomorrow night and Wednesday night before traveling to Tampa for next weekend. Jennifer Fuchitsky is here, meteorologist with Weatherology. Tell us about what appears to be a couple of gorgeous days to get our week started as we look all around the rest of the state. Jennifer, what do you have for us? Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, like you said, it's actually a few gorgeous days expected here, at least for the first part of the work week here. Sunny skies already are becoming sunny for everyone today as a high pressure system is in control for the entire state. Highs in the low 70s for most, slightly cooler around Oshkosh in the mid 60s there. Average highs for this time of the year for the state range between the mid to upper 60s, so a little bit above average for most everyone for everyone today. For Tuesday, starting off with some sunshine, but then a slight chance for rain from Wisconsin Rapids south and east to Waukesha. Otherwise, sunny skies for everyone else. Looks like a warmer day tomorrow as well, with highs getting into the mid to upper 70s as a warm front pushes through. Wednesday, sunny skies across the board, but cooler for everyone as a cold front comes in directly behind tomorrow's warm front, with a pretty significant drop in temperatures, a big range across the state, mid to upper 50s, Oshkosh down to Waukesha and Milwaukee, then mid to upper 60s for Wausau down to Madison over to west central Wisconsin. Then it does look like a chance for rain starting to come in for the second half of the work week by Thursday. Those chances for rain come in by the evening hours in the south, otherwise by the afternoon for central and west central Wisconsin, with overall a brief increase in temperatures for Thursday before cooling back down a little bit by the end of the work week on Friday.
What we have, Jennifer, then is that special time of year where we save money. We don't really need the furnace anymore. We don't need the air conditioner yet. So everything's getting a rest. Although sometimes on some of these mornings, it's a little cold on the Tootsies. But otherwise, again, a money-saving time of year if you can handle some somewhat chilly mornings, right?
It absolutely is. Yeah, get that fresh air in.
There you go. Fresh air. I like a good attitude. Jennifer, thanks so much. Have a great day.
You too.
We get an update every morning from Weatherology and Jennifer Vajitsky, meteorologist, who joins us right after we do the sports at 7:15 on mornings here on Up North News Radio. A quick reminder that Up North News Radio is a separate entity from Civic Media, but we are thrilled to be on Civic Media stations all across Wisconsin weekday mornings from 6 to 8. You can find the work that we do at upnorthnewswi.com and upnorthnewswi on social media. In our last hour, we talked to Sherita Booker from Up North News about the stories that are getting the most views, the most clicks, being read most often on our social media sites. And I wanted to tell you a bit about what you'll find over on the website at upnorthnewswi.com. A couple that I've been working on. One is that late last week, the official COVID emergency ended, the emergency declaration. What does that really mean? And if you consider yourself either uninsured or underinsured from a healthcare standpoint, you'll want to take a look at that and see what is different now and how you might be paying more out of pocket, perhaps not right away for vaccines, testing, or treatment if you get COVID, but eventually, as various supplies and programs start to wind down, you may find that there's more coming out of your pocket that way. We also sum up last week when it was marked as National Tourism and Travel Week across the country and in Wisconsin. And if you didn't hear our discussion about how big a boost tourism provides to the Wisconsin economy, go on and click on that story as well. And one more that I wanted to talk about in a little bit of detail is about agriculture and about the upcoming Farm Bill and how advocates for rural America think that the best way to help family farmers is to take on monopoly power or near monopoly power. It's something we've discussed a few times here with our friend Hans Breitenmoser, who's active in the Wisconsin Farmers Union, that this near monopoly power that is enjoyed by far too many companies means that farmers are not getting the price that they otherwise could for their crops and other goods, their milk and such, if there were more choices in the marketplace. And recently, dozens of rural advocates met in Omaha to talk about their federal and state priorities to help these rural communities. These groups included things like Rural Organizing Education Fund, Farm Action, the State Innovation Exchange, and so forth. And they believe that the problem of market concentration and monopoly power increasingly hurts not only farmers, but consumers and families, and that for far too long, these monopolistic policies have been propped up by the government. It was just last hour that we talked about today is the anniversary of the breakup of Standard Oil, a little over 100 years ago. And the benefits that that brought to consumers when they're given more choice. Now, the pushback lately has been that anytime government does anything, it's socialism, which is 100% wrong. I almost said 1,000%. Can't do that. Journalist, try to be literal. Something can't be 1,000% wrong. It's 100% wrong that anytime government gets involved. In fact, quite the opposite. Capitalism doesn't exist as a fair system the way it's touted without government from time to time, either intervening with guardrails or breaks to do things like break up monopoly power. Because otherwise you get a perversion of capitalism that even takes you outside the realm of capitalism. And we're not looking to have some kind of corporatocracy in this country. We're looking to have a level playing field. That's what government's supposed to do when it does it right, is it looks out for the consumer, it looks out for entrepreneurs, and not just shareholders and political donors. And so a country that wasn't afraid to break up Standard Oil to help most Americans, a government that wasn't afraid to break up AT&T to, again, help American consumers, should not be afraid to look into whether near monopoly power exists in American agriculture. And where this might happen is in the Farm Bill. The Farm Bill is something that's renewed every 5 years or so, has been since the 1930s. And it is a very large catch-all bill that isn't just about, you know, farm subsidies, and it's got school lunch programs in. It's got all kinds of other nutrition programs. It talks about, the agricultural power that certain companies can have. It can get into climate policy. It can get into clean energy. All of these things have to go into a farm bill. And that has to get through a divided Congress, which is not an easy thing to do, but there's always pressure every time this comes up from both the left and the right to not leave this significant piece of legislation hanging to get something done. Now, Republicans, for their part, have already spent months talking about the things that they want to cut from the Farm Bill. They want cuts to things like the Supplemental Nutritional Food Assistance Program, or SNAP, or what I knew as food stamps when I was growing up, when, you know, we actually had the little booklets of these coupons that, you know, my mom had to take to the grocery store as a single mom to buy groceries for us. And again, Republicans are still looking to cut that, even though SNAP helps 41 million Americans to feed their families every year. And it's especially critical to helping keep children out of poverty. So as Congress meets to discuss these things, monopoly power will be among them, along with many other policies that you can weigh in on. And so you can read our article over at upnorthnewswi.com, and then be in touch with your own representative. Whether it's Derek Van Orden in the 3rd District, who's already taking heat for wanting to, you know, slash funding for nutrition programs and for the military as part of this, you know, showdown over the debt ceiling, or either one of Wisconsin senators or your congressional rep, wherever they may be. In each case, it's your input that they're going to need, or they're only going to hear from corporate lobbyists about what they want, which is not necessarily in tandem with what's best for the rest of us. I could not help but notice on Mother's Day yesterday, and plenty of other people noticed as well, that once again, you had an exercise in contrasts with a president and a former president. You have a current president who provided very heartfelt and loving comments about mothers and about his wife, and, you know, just a genuine wish for a happy Mother's Day for the moms out there. And then you had, again, what's now become the holiday tradition from Donald Trump, as wishing a happy holiday, sarcastically, to the haters and the losers and his political enemies who are trying to destroy our country. And he did the same thing at Christmas, and he did the same thing last Thanksgiving, that it's always about the fascists, the socialists, and the communists who are trying to destroy our country, et cetera, et cetera. He did not mention Melania Trump once, his wife, the mother of his youngest child, said nothing about wishing her a happy Mother's Day. She's been a non-entity, you know, in his life, especially on social media, for far too long. This is a former president who maybe was a little miffed about not being able to hold a big rally in Iowa this past weekend, ostensibly because of the weather, even though the weather wasn't bad at the time. There was a tornado watch, but there wasn't anything that imminent, except the one thing that was imminent was an embarrassingly low crowd size, which may have played a role in the decision not to have Trump show up and very few other people that do. And Florida Governor Ron DeSantis quickly tried to fill the void, made a change of plans to get over to Des Moines, as well as the other Iowa places that he had been, and try to win over some fans. It's not clear at all if that's, you know, if DeSantis is gaining traction at this point, but at least there was an effort on the part of DeSantis to go meet people, whereas Trump, you know, essentially cut and run from Iowa, in part because of the prospect of a very low crowd. Instead, we will continue to see the push against immigration, the push against gun safety, the push to repeal Obamacare, all of the typical Republican talking points. And as I was looking at them over the weekend, they all had this common thread that there has been attempts at bipartisan solutions, or at least comprehensive solutions, and no current alternative from the Republicans. I told you in the last hour about how immigration reform is badly needed. You had bipartisan immigration reform that got 68 votes in the Senate in 2013, but Republicans in the House wouldn't take it up. Affordable health care, the Affordable Care Act, we're still waiting on the Trump plan to repeal and replace it with something that Americans would support. And the same goes for gun safety. Again, there's no actual plan that's being put out there where Americans are being asked to consider it and support it. We'll learn more about the League of Women Voters of Wisconsin coming up right after our break here. You're up north.
The Civic Media Network of radio stations across Wisconsin. We are your hometown radio, refreshed.
Here's Pat Kreitlow.
All right, I've said it before, I'm going to say it again. There is nothing partisan about encouraging people to vote. There is nothing partisan about defending democracy. There is nothing partisan about making sure that everybody who is eligible to vote can do so in a way that is not obstructed to them, because voting is a right in this country for those who are citizens and eligible to vote. There are so many groups that we have talked to here on Up North News Radio that also fit in that box, that they are looking to encourage civic participation. And we are thrilled to be able to learn more today about the League of Women Voters of Wisconsin. And Deborah Kronmiller joins us, the executive director. Deborah, good morning.
Good morning, Pat. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you for joining us. So a little birdie told me that it was your birthday. So for you to be doing that as well is greatly appreciated. Thanks for starting your big day with us.
Thank you.
How long have you been executive director at the League of Women Voters?
I've been here over 3.5 years in this role. Mm-hmm. I've been on the state board for over 20 years, and I have been a member of the league for over 30 years.
Over 30 years. What took you in there initially?
You know, I attended a brunch in Appleton, Wisconsin, where I was living at the time, and I met a group of people that were fabulous and asked, you know, a little bit more about the organization, got copies of all of the different position papers. We have positions at the local level, state level, and national level. I read through all those positions and realized, hey, this aligns with me. And so it was a very easy choice then to become a member.
So you used the word fabulous. You thought they were fabulous at the time, and you've read the issue. So I'm going to, by that logic, say you still believe the League of Women Voters is fabulous, that other people would find it as well with those positions. So can you tell us more about those? If somebody were at one of the meetings of your, you know, 20 local chapters, what is it they would learn that they would find compelling and perhaps want to join?
I think the league is on so many levels just a great source of information about our democracy. And, you know, the league is 103 years old, and we have positions on virtually everything government, everything policy. You know, so if you're interested in the environment, or if you're interested in actually government, or how our governmental policies affect individual citizens, we have for years been defending the rights of citizens in the United States. And I think that all of us are very motivated as a result of these deeply rooted, well-researched, consensus-formed positions that you can't beat it. You know, it's just let's get out there and make sure our freedoms are defended.
And that comes back to what I said at the start of the segment here, that there are many positions that one can take out there in the world, and some of them are partisan, and some of them decidedly are not. They are very much things that are pro-democracy, for example, which you can be a Democrat, a Republican, and an independent, and things like that. So let me put the question to you this way. A lot of people, you know, may have biases one way or the other. They may consider themselves strongly conservative or strongly progressive, or they may lean one way or the other. For a group like yours, is there room for people who say, well, I think I lean conservative, but I want to know more about your positions and whether I would feel comfortable there?
Yes, there's space for everyone in the League of Women Voters. Our positions are a product of our research and study about what is good for citizens in the United States. The problem, I think, recently, and this really has not been true for the whole 103-year history of the League of Women Voters, but recently we've seen this division of thought and people wanting to, you know, kind of assert this, you're with me or you're against me. You know, our Constitution gives us certain rights and freedoms, and defending that is what the League of Women Voters has been doing for all these years. And it is not partisan. You know, your freedom to vote is not a partisan issue. Your right to clean air and clean water is not a partisan issue. But it has become, or it has been made to be, a partisan issue very recently. And we're trying to defend against that. We're, you know, in leagues across the state and across the nation, frankly, we've been trying to engage everyone in a conversation about the importance of being civil and having a kind of a kind and gentle discourse so that we can do what we've always done, which is be able to look at the issue, figure out, you know, how we would, you know, assert a position on an issue, and then come to consensus around that. And that's what the League does. And it is not partisan. We are pointedly a nonpartisan organization so that we can welcome anyone into our membership.
And it certainly seems that way to again, look at where you do take positions. Who's against clean water? You know, who's against cleaner? Who's against under education? You say we, you know, want to promote equal educational opportunity for students in elementary, secondary, and higher education. Who's against equal educational opportunity? Again, I'm not seeing anything here that, you know, somebody who is, you know, a conservative or a progressive could take issue with and say, yep, that's exactly coming out of, you know, some other party's platform. It's something that is good for citizenship. Mm-hmm. Another thing that is good for citizenship is free, fair, and accurate elections. And that's really where, you know, the League of Women Voters has more notoriety. And it's not just for the opportunities for candidates to speak to groups, but also making sure that election day itself goes smoothly by observing what's going on. How does that work from a League of Women Voters standpoint in terms of election day monitoring?
The League does many things around elections to ensure that every citizen can exercise their right to vote. You know, in anticipation of an election, we do exactly what you were just mentioning. We try to get information from the candidates about their positions, their beliefs, their values to voters, so voters can make a choice and align their own beliefs with that of the candidate that best suits them. On election day, what we try to ensure is that elections are being administered in the way that our statutes say they should be. We have observers that come out and watch elections, and then we try to collect up information from voters themselves about how their voting experience went, whether they used an absentee ballot, did it come to their home timely, did it get back to their clerk timely, you know, the on election day? Were there long lines at the polling place? Was it easy to vote? Were the signs well marked? What we want to make sure is that every person in Wisconsin's voting experience is a good one, because as the league has been advocating for 103 years, we want everyone who's eligible to vote to go do that. And we always feel that a voter is best equipped to vote if they not only know the issues and the candidates, but have access to the polls.
And so to that end, you do put together a voter experience survey, and you have one up on your website right now for the April voter experience. And it asks how you voted. It asked if you have an issue with voting absentee, and it gives all the various ways, like a ballot didn't arrive, or I couldn't get a witness, or, you know, there wasn't a Dropbox, you know, at the time, or you found the rules confusing. And this is something you've done for multiple elections. And does that inform your communication with lawmakers about making elections easier for eligible voters?
Yes, we compile all the information that we receive from voters and our observers into a report. And in that report, we actually do make recommendations, and we bring those recommendations to the Wisconsin Elections Commission and, you know, let them know what we've heard from voters themselves and from our observers about the process of administering an election. And we've made recommendations over the years about making the polling places more accessible to persons with disabilities. We've had issues with the timing. Elections oftentimes are certified before the next ballot, you know, like the primary elections are being certified at a point that's actually after the point when the general election ballot would be printed. It's like, how do we know that we should be printing those ballots if the election results aren't certified yet? So there's just issues in the statutes and dates sometimes, and things that we've looked at and, you know, kind of realize that this could be better. Doesn't mean it's bad. It just means there's room for improvement. And that's what the league is always striving for, is the best election administration procedures possible, so that everyone has a good voting experience, feels comfortable going to the polls, and is able to have their voice heard.
So we've talked a lot about the organization and its views and its programs, but let's take it to the local level, because as I mentioned earlier, there are 20 different local chapters all around the state. What happens there between elections? What are those local chapters doing and talking about or doing for their local communities?
Well, each local league will set their own agenda, if you will, for the year as to what they would like to prioritize. We've had leagues that prioritize voting and the administration of elections. And so in Milwaukee, they've spent a great amount of time trying to reach into high schools and college campuses to make sure that young people understand how to vote, are registered to vote. They inform new citizens who are recently naturalized. And it's, you know, that's one tactic. In our Manitowoc area, they've been working on mental health for a number of years. And now they've expanded their interest area to include poverty in their area and how to tackle these significant issues. Many of our leagues are deeply engaged with the environment in their area, whether that's PFAS contamination in well water or drinking water systems, and how do we remediate that. But each local league makes these decisions and really concentrates on their priorities for their local community. And I think that's what brings in more local league members, is that, you know, seeing an organization like the League of Women Voters really lift up these community-centric topics and for folks who want to get involved with that interest area, the league gives them an outlet to be an advocate.
And I will say as well that if you go to the League of Women Voters website, lwv.org, or just search for League of Women Voters Wisconsin, and you'll be able to find it. Not only does it outline the 20 chapters, local chapters on a map, but if you click on each individual one, you see, you know, some of their local events, their local priorities. Here, looking at the lacrosse page right now, they have a book club, you know, that they're doing as well. So there's something for everybody there. Can you talk briefly? We've got about a minute left in terms of either are these dues paying members? Do you rely on donations? Can anybody donate and support your efforts?
Yes, anyone can donate. Our members are dues paying. We are a membership organization federated with a national chapter, state chapter, and our local chapters. But it takes more than dues to support the League of Women Voters. We have, the state league now is approaching $1 million budget, and that allows us to have the staff that we need to ensure that we're communicating well, to ensure that we are defending voting rights across the state.
Deborah, thank you so much. It was great to talk to you, to learn more about the League of Women Voters, and we hope to visit again soon and get an update on your events.
Super. Thank you.
All right. Happy birthday. Have a great day. We will be back with Terry Bell, 3 Things You Should Know to Start the Week, coming up next. You're up north. Well, Aaron, this would normally be the time that we talk to Terry Bell with 3 Things You Should Know to start the week. And previously, Mr. Bell was there at your old studio. Now it appears Mr. Bell is joining us from the new studio, and there he is now. Terry, good morning.
Sorry to be running late. I apologize for that.
That's okay. It's the news business. We
so much to keep track of.
I'm sure the news involved, you know, going the extra distance for that cup of coffee. What? How do you fuel up in the morning over there?
Coffee, basically. We've got a coffee maker. It's good to go.
All right. Well, yeah. I mean, because you're where you are now. I mean, there's no shortage of Capital Square coffee joints where you can have the honor of paying maybe $10 for a cup of coffee. So I'm glad to hear there's just a plain old coffee pot there.
That's just, you know, the good old fashioned way.
Yes, that'll definitely work for us. Mm. All right, let's get going here on 3 things that you should know to start the week, stories that are either ongoing or will be happening. And where would you like to start today?
Well, we'll start at the southern border of the United States. Last week, Title 42, that was the pandemic era restrictions on immigration that were put in place during the Trump administration. And those were put in place largely for pandemic-related concerns. Well, those restrictions were lifted last week, and we have varying reports as to how busy the things are at different locations along the border crossing. It seems that things are quite busy in some places and rather calm in others. There's been a lot of legal wrangling going on. Late on Thursday, a federal judge in Florida blocked the government from releasing migrants without a notice to appear in immigration court. That had apparently been done routinely by prior administrations, but the White House says it's sabotage. And there's criticism coming from human rights groups who are filing a lawsuit recently challenging a new Biden administration rule limiting who qualifies for asylum. So even the Biden White House acknowledges that this is a very, very tricky situation for them and a potential liability.
Well, especially since, as news programs pointed out over the weekend, you know, we're still dealing with rules about asylum that date back to World War II and people that were escaping persecution from, you know, communist countries and the, you know, the Eastern Bloc and things like that, rather than folks on our own continent or from South and Central America, which doesn't make their concerns any less valid, but the system itself hasn't been modernized. And as we talked about earlier in the show, there was a full comprehensive way to do this in 2013. Just a small group of House Republicans said no, and there's been no alternative ever since to get this fixed. And so it is a mess, but it's not a new mess. This is a mess that goes back quite some ways that we're going to be following this week.
For a long time, yeah.
Yeah. All right. What's number two?
Well, the state budget is moving forward. A big meeting for actually a big week for the shaping the state budget. The Joint Finance Committee scheduled to meet twice this week, Tuesday and Thursday. The Assembly is expected to take a key vote on Wednesday regarding the shared revenue bill. This is an historic reimagining of how the state shares the money that it collects and distributes throughout the state. The proposal that everyone seems to agree on is that there'll be more money collected from the state sales tax. It will be strictly state sales tax money that will be distributed, 20% of it. And that should mean at least a 10% increase for local governments around Wisconsin. But some will get more than others, and that's where things get a little tricky. The bill passed out of an assembly committee last week without a lot of amendments that were expected. A lot of concerns were raised during a public hearing last week that really were not brought up in that meeting last week. Democrats were very critical. They said, why are we steamrolling this, going so fast? Republicans say, you know, we will hash out the differences on these amendments when it gets to the floor on Wednesday. This is really nothing to be particularly alarmed about, but it's still a battle over whether or not, among other things, whether or not Milwaukee and Milwaukee County will be bound to hold referendums in order to increase sales taxes.
Right. Again, for a group of Republicans that are all about taking what they say are extra things out of the budget that were proposed by Governor Evers. Now Democrats are saying to them, why don't we do the same with your shared revenue plan? Why these things that, you know, tie the hands of local officials? And apparently it's a different matter when it's their bill. But again, the main point remains that there will be some progress this week, but not nearly the progress there would be if Republican legislative leaders would simply sit down with the governor and look for areas of agreement. And we have to get past this show pony phase, if you will, where everybody shows off how great their options are, and then we actually get in a room and do the actual work of finding agreements.
That's what appears what will likely happen. You know, this is especially important for law enforcement, and we're going to be talking about that on the newscast throughout the day on Civic Media about what this funding means, what this formula means for law enforcement, and this possibility that in Milwaukee and Milwaukee County, sales taxes will go to referendum, and sometimes, you know, more money for police, fire, sheriff's department protections will be a part of this. And law enforcement and public safety leaders are really concerned about, you know, what happens when these, if and when these referendums don't succeed.
All right. And that takes us to number three, which involves some individual legislators.
Right. And I think as we were preparing for this segment last week, we agreed that these are signs of, I think, the up and coming next generation in government, the youth movement, so to speak. Melissa Agard is taking her cannabis legalization tour around Wisconsin. I think she's going to be in your neck of the woods soon.
She will be appearing on these fine airwaves Wednesday morning at 7:30 as part of her grassroots tour. See what she did there? Marijuana grassroots.
Yeah.
Because she has there will be events in Eau Claire and Wausau coming up that she'll be talking about. So yeah, that's Wednesday at 7:30. She'll be doing that.
Right. And all polling from all directions shows that this is a popular idea that remains bottlenecked in at the governmental level. And Senator Agard is trying to do something about that. Another sign of the next generation coming up, Francesca Hong, the state representative from Madison, getting some recognition from the Gen 10 leaders. Gen X, I believe, is the organization that puts out this Gen Next, I should say.
Next Gen. Yeah, Next Gen.
Thank you.
For the next generation of leaders. Yes. And she's on, I think, a top 10 list nationally of of up-and-coming leaders.
Right. So I think that just goes to show that, you know, what she's doing in Wisconsin is making a difference and getting some notice around the country.
Yes, and she will be here to talk about that on Friday morning at 7:05. So we'll look forward to her leadership, what she has to say about showing that as she continues her nascent career in the legislature. Terry Bell, Civic Media News Director, thank you so much. Have a great start to the week.
Thank you, Pat.
All right. Good to have all of you here as well. Remember, you can follow me throughout the day. You just go to Facebook and my political posts are on a page called Pat Kreitlow Up North, all one word. And again, you can catch the Up North News work overall at upnorthnewswi.com. Have a great Monday. We'll see you back here Tuesday morning, 6 a.m.